Thank you all for coming to this panel, which is sponsored by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group. My name is Scott Keefe, and I'm a member of the Practice Group Executive Committee. It's my job and my honor and privilege today to introduce our moderator, the Honorable Ryan T. Holt, Judge on the United States Court of Federal Claims. As we think about the Federalist Society Intellectual Property Practice Group and Judge Holt, I hope that we can collectively think about an opportunity for each of you here in the room or out in the audience online, an opportunity to get involved and make a difference. Judge Holt is a perfect example of getting involved and making a difference through the Intellectual Property Practice Group of the Federalist Society. I met Judge Holt at a Federalist Society event at his law school when he was a law student. I wish I could claim to have been his professor. He learned all the great things that he knows from many other great people. I don't get to claim that. He earned that, and he did that. And more than earning and learning, then Ryan Holt, having graduated from the California Maritime Academy and then graduating from University of California Davis Law School, went out and practiced. He also worked as a law clerk for not one, but two wonderful federal judges. And he worked at great law firms and other great parts of the United States government. He then went on and became a law professor, teaching students, many of whom are here. It's great to see familiar faces, teaching us, his now peers, colleagues in the academy, teaching all of us as fellow practitioners, and then was nominated and confirmed by the United States Senate to serve as a judge on the Court of Federal Claims. He's married to a great wife. They are parents of two great children. Nothing could be more fun than to see the greatness that the Honorable Ryan T. Holt has shown now throughout his professional career as he has made his way through the Federalist Society Practice Group. It is a chance to get involved, a chance to make a difference, a chance to be just like Judge Holt. Please, Judge Holt.
Well, thank you, Scott. So let that be a lesson to everyone. Have friends introduce you. Always helpful. And if you need to fill up an intellectual property room discussion during a Federalist Society event, fill it up with law clerks and students. We have a good crowd here. And I've hosted and moderated this panel a couple times before, and it's always proven to be a lively discussion. We've even had some sparks fly. So we look forward to that today, and we have a very distinguished group of speakers. So the panel is titled IP Law and Culture, and we look forward to a very lively debate about trademark law context, recent Supreme Court cases, and a couple other issues. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce our panel, beginning from my left, and we'll be speaking in this order with introductory remarks and then comments between the panelists. So first is Professor Lisa Ramsey, who joins us from the University of San Diego School of Law. She's a professor of law, where she is also a founding member of the Center for Intellectual Property Law and Markets. She teaches and writes in the intellectual property and international intellectual property law area and is an expert on trademark law. Before joining the USD law faculty, she was an IP litigator at Gray Carey and served as a law clerk for Judge Rebecca Beach Smith on the Eastern District of Virginia. Professor Ramsey's scholarship focuses on potential conflicts between trademark laws and free speech rights and explains how trademark protection of inherently valuable words, symbols, and product features can harm fair competition and freedom of expression. Next on our panel is Professor Robert Spoo from the University of Tulsa College of Law. He's also an Associate Dean for Faculty Development and the Chapman Distinguished Professor of Law. He teaches copyright law, property, contracts law, and literature, and other subjects. He received his PhD in English from Princeton University and his JD from Yale Law School. After serving as a law clerk for Justice Sotomayor while she served on the Second Circuit, Professor Spoo was an attorney with law firms in New York, San Francisco, and Tulsa. He's published extensively on modern authors, law and literature, copyrights, and the public domain. He is a co-editor with Simon Stern of a law and literature series with Oxford University Press. In 2020, Spoo was on leave with a law and public affairs fellowship from Princeton University, where his project for the university was Lawful Piracy and Trade Courtesy in the American Copyright Vacuum. Next on our panel is the Honorable Karen Temple from the Motion Picture Association. She is currently the Senior Executive Vice President and Global General Counsel for the Motion Picture Association. Previous to that, she served as the Acting Register of Copyrights from October 2016 to March of 2019, and then as the Register of Copyrights and the Director of the United States Copyright Office from March 2019 to January 2020. From 2013 to 2016, she served as an Associate Register of Copyrights and the Director of Policy and International Affairs for the United States Copyright Office. Previously, she also worked as Senior Counsel to the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, where she helped manage the DOJ's Task Force on Intellectual Property, and spent several years as Vice President, Litigation and Legal Affairs for the Recording Industries of America, as well as working for the law firm Williams & Connolly. Of note, Billboard magazine has described her as, and I quote, seen as being even-handed in the kinds of intellectual property issues that have become contentious in the digital age, and the Professional Photographers of America say she has demonstrated a thoughtful approach to copyright policy and to copyright office management overall. I hope that Billboard magazine will have anything to say about me one day, but I doubt that will be possible. And then finally, Professor Sandra Esters of the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University is a senior fellow for copyright research and policy and a senior scholar at the Center for Intellectual Property X Innovation Policy. She also leads the law school's Arts and Entertainment Advocacy Program. Professor Esters has over 20 years of advocacy experience on behalf of copyright and other intellectual property owners. She has served on trade missions and been an industry advisor to the Department of Commerce on intellectual property implications for international trade negotiations, worked on legislative and regulatory matters worldwide, and frequently testifies before Congress and federal agencies regarding intellectual property matters. Immediately prior to joining Scalia Law, she was the Chief Executive Officer of the Copyright Alliance, which is a nonprofit public interest organization that represents the interests of artists and creators across the creative spectrum. She's also previously served as Vice President and Associate General Counsel at Time Warner. She began her legal career in private practice at the law firm Weil Gotshal. So to get things started, we've prepared questions that folks have agreed to and have notes from Professor Keefe here. A couple of logistical notes. For the attendees seeking CLE credit, you are required to sign in each day to receive credit. If you've not already done so, please use the QR code on the CLE card provided. If you don't have that, there are volunteers with extra cards in the room. The QR code is also posted outside the room. And as a final note, per DC regulations, please wear a mask unless eating, drinking, or presenting your talk. So with that, let's begin with an initially prepared question for Professor Ramsey to get us started. And again, we'll have 5 to 10 minutes of opening comments for each speaker and then engagement between the panel and plenty of time for questions after from the audience.
Would you like us to stay seated or move up to the podium?
Yeah, up to you. I'm obviously staying here. Okay. So, but do whatever is most comfortable. Go ahead. And to get us started off, our first opening question for Professor Ramsey. So the U.S. Supreme Court recently held in Tam and Brunetti that trademark laws banning registration of immoral, scandalous, and disparaging marks violate the right to free speech in the First Amendment. Are there any other trademark laws which might be found unconstitutional if courts subjected them to First Amendment scrutiny?
All right, well, thank you for that question. So first, I want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak today, and thank all of you for coming to our presentation. So most trademark laws will be constitutional after Tam and Brunetti, right? Laws that regulate misleading uses of trademarks, laws that promote competition, those are all going to be fine after Tam and after Brunetti. But there are some laws which are not constitutional, I believe, and others have argued that trademark dilution laws are not constitutional regulations of speech. They regulate expression that is not misleading, and I'm going to argue today that they are anti-competitive and harm expression too much. Also today, I'm going to talk about the fact that trademark laws allow registration and protection of expression that had inherent communicative value before someone adopted it, adopted that mark in connection with the sale of its goods and services. It has value in an industry or in a community. So this would include things like political messages, trending rallying cries, memes, common phrases, swear words, slurs, other things that people often like to put on the front of a t-shirt. So first I'm going to talk about what I have called inherently valuable expression in my scholarship, and then I will talk about trademark dilution law. So I'd mentioned before some examples of inherently valuable expression. You might have seen in the news media today, people have applied to register phrases like "Let's go Brandon," "Trump too small," "Black Lives Matter," "I survived the coronavirus," for apparel such as t-shirts, right, coffee mugs, flags, other kinds like wall hanging, decorations, also phrases like "God bless the USA." And I think that it's unfortunate that trademark law encourages people to do this. But what the applicants say is, look, we already have registered trademarks that are political slogans. "Make America Great Again" is an example. It's not just a registered slogan for a political action committee. It's also a registered slogan for apparel, stickers, and other kinds of what I call expressive merchandise, right? The kinds of goods that you might buy to express a message. There are also registrations for the phrase "life is good," for the word "lifeguard" that's displayed on the front of shirts for apparel, and registrations for "I love you" for wine. The trademark office is often inconsistent in what it will register and not register. It's just as inconsistent as it was with regard to Section 2A of the Lanham Act when it banned registration of terms that were disparaging, immoral, or scandalous. So "I love you" is registered as a mark for wine, but the trademark office refused to register "I love you" for jewelry on the ground that it failed to function as a trademark because it was decorative. The phrase "I heart New York" is a registered trademark. "I heart DC was refused registration on the ground that it fails to function as a trademark. Now, I think anyone should be able to put these common phrases, right, these symbols on the front of t-shirts. And it's unfortunate that trademark law allows parties to register these kinds of trademarks. So what I think is that Congress, just like the court, should consider whether trademark laws are constitutional. We currently have a trademark statute which says that you can't cancel a trademark on the ground it lacks distinctiveness or fails to function as a trademark. If it's been registered for 5 years, and then if you apply to make that or your right to use that registration incontestable after 5 years, you can't argue as a defendant in litigation that the trademark is not distinctive or that it fails to function as a trademark. So as a result, if you're a small business that enters the market 6 years after that registration, you no longer have these defenses. You can argue the term is generic, maybe that it is aesthetically functional, maybe argue it's been abandoned due to third-party use. But the problem is that you can't have these defenses, which should apply if trademark law is supposed to protect words and symbols that identify the source of goods and services. So that's one law that I think should be struck down after Tam and Brunetti. Trademark dilution law is another law that is problematic, and I'm not the only scholar that has argued that dilution law is unconstitutional. Even before the Tam case, a number of people have argued that trademark dilution law would not even satisfy intermediate constitutional scrutiny under the central Hudson test. I actually think that dilution law is viewpoint discriminatory, just like the disparagement, scandalous mark, and the immoral mark clauses. First of all, dilution by tarnishment is a cause of action that you can bring when the use of the trademark is not confusing, when there's no evidence of any actual harm, When the parties are not competitors. And you can sue somebody for tarnishment when your use of a mark is going to harm the reputation of the trademark owner. As long as there's an association between your company and the other company, you might be liable. So for example, Victoria's Secret sued Victor Mosley and his wife, who had a retail store that sold sex toys in addition to lingerie, when the name of their shop was Victor's Secret. They changed it to Victor's Little Secret after that, but that didn't satisfy Victoria's Secret. Now, the Sixth Circuit held that there was no, that did admitted that the, that any harm to Victoria's Secret was speculative. First Amendment law says you can't justify a restriction on expression if the harm is speculative. So, tarnishment provisions are usually applied in the context of sex-related products or illegal drugs, and so the kinds of things that some people might be find to be offensive. So, I think most people that pay attention to these issues have said that the tarnishment provision is very likely to be found unconstitutional if courts actually subjected it to scrutiny. Of course, the question is, will they do that? The blurring provision, though, I think is also suspect because blurring says that you have to prove that this association impairs the distinctiveness or uniqueness of the mark. And again, leading scholars, including Professor McCarthy, who's a leading treatise writer on trademark law, has said it's not clear that there's really any evidence that just because you associate two different marks, that this is going to impair the distinctiveness of the mark or harm its reputation. So the problem is people just haven't really proven that there is harm to the distinctiveness of the mark or to its reputation. So when you have a blurring claim, you're basically saying that the defendant's message is inconsistent with the brand message of the large famous owner of the mark. And so the use is not confusing, though. So you have to think, okay, well, why are we regulating speech in this context? Some people say, well, we're protecting the investment in the mark, right? The amount of money that you spent. But the problem with that is that trademark law doesn't have a goal of protecting investments in trademarks, right? We're protecting fair competition. We're preventing misleading uses of trademarks. We don't protect the investment if your term is generic, if the subject matter is functional, or if it's deceptive. So it's true that trademark laws protect your goodwill, your reputation. But at the same time, if we prevent misleading uses of trademarks, which we do in infringement law, that's also going to protect the goodwill in your mark. It's going to protect the reputation of the mark. So we don't need dilution law in this context to protect trademark owners. Trademark dilution laws harm expression more than necessary because they give you rights across industries. You can sue people who are not competitors and anyone else if they associate the third party's mark with the famous mark. So I think this is problematic. So if you actually apply First Amendment scrutiny to the dilution law, I think that courts would find both the tarnishment provision and the blurring provision to be unconstitutional. There are some defenses to dilution, but I submit that they're not enough to protect expressive uses of trademarks. So in my scholarship, I've argued that one of the problems with trademark law is it doesn't provide predictability or clarity to parties accused of infringement. So one way to do that would be to, number one, require use of a mark to be misleading for liability and to get rid of the dilution cause of action. That will provide more certainty. Another way to increase certainty would be to add more statutory defenses. Some people propose having a commercial use requirement or a trademark use requirement, but the problem is some commercial uses of trademarks are confusing, and some non-commercial uses and non-trademark uses can be confusing. So instead, I think we want to focus on whether a use misleads regarding the source of the products and have defenses for when you use a trademark in an expressive way to provide information as part of decoration or if you're using a trademark in a functional manner. You don't have to necessarily invalidate the trademark of the plaintiff, but I think that it's the best way to balance trademark and free speech rights is not just for courts, but for legislatures, trademark offices to start paying more attention to whether trademark laws are consistent with the right to freedom of expression. Thank you. Great.
Thank you, Professor Ramsey. New first, never had sex toys mentioned at a Federalist Society panel before. it had to come out during the trademark talk. So now we'll transition to Professor Spu at the University of Tulsa College of Law. Would you like to remain in place?
I think I'll be a fixture here.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Opening question for Professor Spu's remarks. As a literature scholar and an English professor turned law professor, what role do you feel copyright and the fair use doctrine play or should play in the building of culture?
Thank you, Judge Holt, and thank you for moderating and the kind remarks introducing us. And thank you to the Federalist Society for this invitation. It's a great opportunity to meet you and speak here today. I'd like to offer a few thoughts about copyright and culture. Let me begin with a disclosure and a caution. My background as a scholar of modern literature tends to crowd my foreground as a legal scholar. My research on modernism has, I suppose, given me an occupational bias in favor of quotation, allusion, and all manner of cultural borrowing. Think James Joyce, Ezra Pound, Virginia Woolf, and those great borrowers of the modern period. The caution is that I don't know what we really intend by the word culture, and I don't just mean this distinguished panel, I mean IP scholars generally. One question hovering behind the theme of IP and culture is, does copyright promote or hinder culture? Does this limited monopoly properly incentivize creativity while still allowing enough unauthorized borrowing to nourish collateral creativity? Seems to me that copyright usually thinks of culture as quantity, this more the merrier idea of culture, more books, movies, paintings, songs, sound recordings, is about the only thing copyright asks, or maybe today can ask, of creative incentives. The question of quality, the slow process of selecting and sifting from the quantity, is more a job for culture than for copyright. But the doctrine of fair use does get into the question of quality, or at least the question of aesthetic forms and types. Despite Justice Holmes' famous warning that judges should not get into aesthetic questions, fair use in some ways does make judges into arbiters of aesthetic questions, especially since the doctrinal turn some three decades ago to the criterion of transformativeness as a measure of the fairness of an unauthorized use. Whether a use is transformative in purpose or character, now the first question that most federal courts ask in a fair use analysis tests the aesthetic form of the defendant's use and sometimes the aesthetic quality of the plaintiff's work. Does the defendant's copy comment on or critique the copyrighted work, courts ask under the first statutory fair use factor? Is the copyrighted work creative or fanciful enough to be deemed at the core of copyright's purposes, courts ask under the second factor? Approved uses have included ones that comment on or criticize the copyrighted work, such as parodies, news reporting, and book reviews. Uses that somehow recontextualize or repurpose the copyrighted work, such as the use of thumbnail images for indexing the internet, or reproducing concert posters in a published history of a rock band. And in the Supreme Court's most recent fair use pronouncement, uses that enable others to engage in progress-enhancing creativity by sharing a re-implemented computer interface that allows them, these others, to write new beneficial program code. But fair use cases that try to test what many others mean by culture have emerged slowly and recently in many ways, kinds of copying that don't quite fit into the transformative categories of commenting, repurposing, or re-implementing. These include what we might think of as aesthetic transformations. The thriving subculture of mashups and remixes is one type. Less than a year ago, the Ninth Circuit ruled that an unauthorized mashup that combined Star Trek characters with the appealing visual style and clever doggerel of Dr. Seuss was not a fair use, largely because the mashup embodied the wrong kind of transformativeness. It did not parody any Zeus work or subject it to comment or ridicule. It merely, as the court put it, repackaged the Zeus work into a new format. Similarly, the Second Circuit, earlier this year, held that a series of unauthorized silkscreen prints created some years ago by Andy Warhol on the basis of a photograph of the musical artist Prince did not embody fair use transformativeness. Transformative use need not always comment on or parody the protected work, the court said, but it must be, and these are the court's words, something more than the imposition of another artist's style on the primary work. It must embody a distinct purpose, one that conveys a new meaning or message, and yet remains both recognizably deriving from and retaining the essential elements of its source material, unquote. The Zeus and Warhol appellate decisions were reversals of trial court findings of transformative fair use. So fair use was found below, reversed above. These cases collectively betray judicial anxiety about unauthorized cultural borrowing. How may it be confined so that fair uses don't invade and possibly crowd out copyright's legitimate markets for derivative works, as they are called? Adaptations. Fair use cases and the Copyright Act both use the word transform to define, respectively, fair use copying by borrowers and the exclusive derivative work right of copyright owners. What to do about this terminological overlap, as Amici called it in the Zeus case? The overlap is really more than terminological. A thriving fan culture produces mashups, remixes, and sequels of iconic cultural materials, Star Trek, Dr. Seuss, Harry Potter, Batman, Wonder Woman. For the most part, these passionate emulations remain unpublished in blogs and chat rooms, largely unchallenged by copyright owners. But when they threaten to become published in print format, as did the Zeus Trek mashup, or some years ago, a Harry Potter lexicon, then litigation looms. That's interesting published, unpublished dichotomy that exists in this fan culture context. What kinds of culture does fair use want to nourish? I think that's the main question that I'm posing during these remarks. Mashups, the combining of elements of two or more works, are in the unenviable position of being poor candidates for both licensing and for a fair use finding. To be free from legal doubt, a typical mashup creator would have to obtain licenses for all chosen mashed works, at least two, possibly more. Alternatively, to come within the core of fair use, the mashup creator must ensure that the mashup parodies, criticizes, or comments on all the chosen mashed works. A tall order for any borrower, and possibly an aesthetically debilitating one, since it would inject a utilitarian purpose into a project that may have other aesthetic or cultural goals. Here, the modernist scholar in me wonders if Joyce, Pound, and other early 20th century authors, the mashup artists of their day, could have written as they did under our present copyright regime. We are surrounded, saturated even, by markets for famous brands. We are urged to inhabit, as consumers, a world of culture created by others. What are our rights as tenants of that culture? Fair use might be a kind of implied warranty of habitability, but does it give cultural tenants more than a right merely to protest their living conditions by means of parody or comment? 30 years ago, Judge Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit, in a fair use case, articulated one of copyright's persistent paradoxes. As he wrote, "Before the first work is published, broad protection of intellectual property seems best. After it is published, narrow protection seems best." He was thinking primarily of the creation of works, not necessarily their distribution. How can a single copyright law, though, under his paradox, and a one-size-fits-all copyright in many ways as well, manage a progress-enhancing bait-and-switch in which incentives to create are maximized while opportunities for lawful unauthorized copying remain strong. Both creating and borrowing build culture, however else we might define it, and every act of creating or borrowing involves both creation and borrowing. Since copyrights are long and strong in their duration and scope, and since we must be able to borrow to have any culture at all, how can fair use and other copyright doctrines and provisions ensure a spacious public domain while still encouraging authors to create without the fear of unchecked free riding? That's IP's task and culture's challenge. I don't pretend to be able to answer that broad question today or fully ever. I simply raise it for this learned panel and audience. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Professor Spoo. So next on our panel is the Honorable Karen Temple from the Motion Picture Association. The opening question for Karen is that there seems to be a reckoning right now between so-called big tech and the government, with a new recognition that online platforms such as Google and Facebook have amassed significant power and should be held to a higher standard in terms of policing what's on their services. How do these discussions impact copyright infringement and in particular the DMCA?
Great, thank you for the question. First, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society, of course, for this kind invitation, and Judge Holt for the kind words and the initial question. I also look forward to the debate on the panel. I have some strong views on fair use, so I look forward to discussing them with Professor Spoo, but I know that Sandra will be also talking about it, so I think that there will be a lively discussion on fair use. For my talk, you know, I wanna take the idea of culture and a little bit more high level, and I think that there are important conversations that you alluded to in that question about what type of culture we want and expect to have on the internet right now. So there are conversations taking place as to the level of responsibility that online platforms should have in terms of the culture of the internet, as well as the type of responsibility platforms have outside of the internet and their effect on activity that takes place outside of the internet. While certainly it's not kind of directly related, some of the discussions regarding the responsibility of online platforms, for example, conversations about CDA, are not directly related to copyright infringements. Obviously, the CDA carves out intellectual property. I think the tone of the conversations right now going on in Washington, D.C., in terms of the responsibility for online platforms with respect to what goes on through their pipes and on their services is an important one. And the fact that this tone is actually changing and has changed over the course of the last several years with, a growing recognition that we have, in some instances, given online platforms such as Google and Facebook and others a pass when it comes to responsibility for content on their services. If you recall, at the time that the two laws that really regulate how these platforms are supposed to operate, Section 230 of the CDA and the DMCA were developed. At the times those were developed, we really did have a different cultural environment when it's thought of with respect to the responsibility of online platforms. There was a feeling that there needed to be absolutely no regulation of these platforms whatsoever, that, you know, that would be anathema to the fact or the ability of these platforms to grow. And so any regulations was seen as something that would stifle the ability of the internet to grow. So despite real concerns about how big these platforms could become, how much power they were developing, the law developed in a way to give them even more and more power. Case law that was occurring at the time with respect to the responsibility of these platforms either held in favor of the platforms and found that they didn't have any responsibility to police what was going on in terms of their services, or if there were cases that came out and intimated that there might be a higher standard of responsibility placed on these platforms, Congress actually actively decided to overrule those cases with legislation. So, for example, example. Obviously, pre-DMCA, we had several cases, such as the Playboy versus Frina case, Sega case, Netcom case, where there was a feeling that bulletin boards at the time might have some responsibility over what was posted on their services. Congress then immediately overruled those cases with respect through the DMCA. Similarly, there was a significant case pre the CDA called Oakmont versus Progeny, which also intimated that there might be some responsibility of online services as publishers, so they would be treated similarly to just physical publishers and be responsible for some of the things that were being published on their services, and the courts did hold that there might be some responsibility, and Congress decided again to overrule that decision by saying, no, we need to protect the ability of these online platforms to grow, so therefore we want to ensure that they have immunity for everything that's going on their services. Recently, of course, we in the Washington, D.C. have observed what has been called often the tech lash, where there's a growing recognition that having no responsibility for the culture of the internet, for what's going on these services, has led to these services being able to become bigger and to be able to really allow themselves to be arbiters in a way that pushes government out of the equation. They can choose what they want to take off their services and what they want to allow to have on their services without any real regulatory oversight. So they might choose to ignore, in some instances, copyright infringement on their services, but nevertheless remove instances of speech that they disagree with on their services. The Senate Judiciary IP Subcommittee has looked at these issues for some time. Senator Tillis and Senator Coons have been extremely active in this regard. They held 7 hearings over the course of the last 2 years on the DMCA and numerous roundtables. The House Judiciary Committee has also begun to look at these issues in detail. And I think, again, there's no question that although the CDA is much different than the DMCA, that, again, the overall environment in which we're looking at the responsibility of online platforms has changed. Last year, the Copyright Office released a report on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, on the DMCA, and the headline from that, at least the headline I took from that, was their quote that the balance between technology and content had become askew. And from my perspective, askew means that that balance does not exist anymore. And I think that that, again, is a combination of case law, judicial interpretation, as well as the initial purpose behind the DMCA, which was to give a broad immunity for these online platforms, that has created a environment, again, where there is a feeling that they should have no responsibility for what occurs. The U.S. Copyright Office, on their platforms, the U.S. Copyright Office reviewed a number of cases that had interpreted broadly the provisions of the DMCA. So you're starting off with a provision that already is kind of purposed to create a pretty broad immunity for online platforms, and then you have cases that are coming out that are defining and interpreting those provisions in a way that even provides more immunity than I think the drafters had initially anticipated. So they pointed out things such as the definitions of service providers that under Section 512A and how broadly that has been interpreted to include a number of service providers that are not merely passive conduits, but actually have more active roles in terms of what goes on their services. The issue of what repeat infringer standards would be required under Section 512I has also been interpreted very, very broadly to allow for services to escape liability even if they did not have strong repeat infringer policy. Red flag knowledge under Section 512C has also been read pretty broadly to be, in some people's views, completely excised from the statute, and so that a service has no obligation to actually take action to take down something on the, some copyright infringement on their site unless they have pretty much actual knowledge, even though they're supposed to be a standard of both actual knowledge and constructive or red flag knowledge. The provision with respect to 512H on subpoenas has been broadly interpreted to not allow content industries to be able to subpoena information with respect to P2P services. Again, something that has hampered the ability of those content industry to be able to appropriately police what's on the platforms. So all of the case law that has come down over the last 10 years, the Copyright Office concluded, really did contribute to this culture that has allowed online platforms to escape liability in instances where they should have some more responsibility for what has gone on in their on their services. Senator Tillis released just last year a discussion draft on the DMCA that goes into a number of these issues as to whether there are areas within the DMCA that could be reformed. I think those conversations taking place now in a environment in which we recognize the responsibility of online platforms is a positive development and one that will allow us to potentially see if there are areas either for agreement between content and technology or where there are issues that Congress may need to get involved. So kind of just in conclusion, before we go on to the panel, I would say, you know, I think the IP culture wars, so to speak, that have been taking place have really changed over the course of the last 2 years. And before, it was a kind of big tech versus big content. And I think big content was seen as the more aggressive bad guy. And so the laws that we were developed, the case law that was issued, really skewed, I think, in an unbalanced way in their favor, you know, the responsibility or lack of responsibility that online platforms had have on the internet. Now, given the environment that we are facing and the recognition that maybe we did allow the government and judges allow too much freedom with respect to online services to be able to control on their own without any type of regulatory oversight what goes on their services, that we do need to have some type of correction. And again, while I don't think the issues of CDA, which are have been discussed, and those are going to be, I think, really aggressively reviewed by Congress, are necessarily completely in tune with the DMCA. I just think that the environment in which those conversations are taking place are really important, and they're important so that we kind of even the playing field in terms of the environment so that we can have a real-world conversation about what level of responsibility online platforms should have in the online ecosystem.
Great. Well, thank you, Karen. Let's give Karen a round of applause. All right, and final opening comments from our panel before we move to questions from panelist to panelist and then questions from the audience is for Sandra. So the opening question for Sandra's opening remarks, building off Robert's discussion, what is your view about how the transformativeness test is faring in the real world, especially as it relates to copyright owners beyond the software community?
Thank you. I want to thank the Federalist Society, as everyone on the panel has done, for inviting me. I always enjoy participating in these events and in the lively dialogue, both with the participants of the audience and with the participants on the panel, and I'm sure we'll have that today as well. I'd like to begin by observing that copyright is not an issue where there is the typical right-left political split, as there tends to be in DC on many issues, but rather what some have called a copyright copyleft or a believer versus skeptic in the copyright space split in views. And as Karen has noted so ably, that split is often based on whether one's affinities lie with the so-called creative community or the user or sometimes tech community. And that's because, in, at least in my observation, many of the issues that we talk about, the creative community relies on the rights that are granted by copyright in order to build and to preserve their livelihoods, while the user or the tech communities find those rights to be a weight on their business or their creative endeavors. And nowhere are these divides between viewpoints more sharply articulated than over the issue of fair use. And you know, this is, of course, an oversimplification, because if you do a proper examination of the litigation of fair use issues, I think perhaps all of us would agree that no one depends more on fair use than artists, creators themselves. So if we are to rely on fair use to resolve disputes over alleged infringements, it's very important to get the balance right. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to grant rights to authors for the purpose of promoting progress, but the law strikes not one single balance, but multiple subtle balances, which includes balances between authors within a single creative community, between primary and secondary authors using different types of works, between authors of different types of works within the larger creative sector who might be affected by copyright rulings, you know, brought by another creator, you know, within the creative community, between authors and distributors or other intermediaries they might deal with, between authors and their audiences, between authors and those who would use their works for other purposes, perhaps as content on a service around which you might collect data from users and sell advertising. And most importantly, perhaps, between authors and society at large. So this underscores the importance of neutral and predictable decision-making by the judiciary, which can then be applied by laymen in the field when resolving a copyright matter so as not to disrupt relationships throughout the creative ecosystem. So for a number of years leading up to the Google v. Oracle decision, and I'll tell you that decision itself was not one single decision, but many decisions going up and down for a decade or more, whether they were skeptics or believers in copyright, notable figures in academia, such as Jane Ginsburg, Barton Beebe, and others, observed that ever since the adoption of the transformative use test in 1994, as a means of looking at the first statutory fair use factor, which looks at the nature and purpose of the use, that test has pretty much overtaken everything, all of the other factors. And in 2019, Jerry Liu, another excellent scholar, performed a comprehensive empirical study of transformative use in copyright law, and he found that when that test is used in deciding the first factor, 94% of decisions upheld fair use, a finding of fair use. Transformativeness overrode commercial purpose and bad faith, if that had occurred in a fact pattern, 100% of the time. It rendered the matter of whether a work was unpublished or creative totally irrelevant under factor two, and it often allowed for 100% verbatim copying. And it also allowed courts to ignore evidence of damage to derivative markets when rendering their opinions. And all of this might make you think, okay, well, that makes it much easier to decide cases, much more predictable. But no, decisions were no more predictable because courts diverged widely on the meaning of what is transformative and based the decisions on policy concerns that had arisen, and worse yet, policy concerns that arose often years after the cases were originally instituted. So, you know, cases often take a long time to decide in the federal courts. So the if you are a deep-pocketed litigant, you are able to begin the case, you continue engaging in the activity over time. And a good example of this is the Google Books case. When Google Books began, there was great outrage. How could it be? How can you go and digitize all the nation's libraries' books? You know, definitely it will be found to be copyright infringement. And by the time the case was resolved, the decision rendered opined what a wonderful public service this was. And of course, it had to be found to be, you know, transformative, fair use. At bottom, deciding cases on the basis of fair use and on transformativeness is not necessarily helpful to creators in their creative process because it is not particularly predictable to the creator as they are engaged in their acts of creativity. Google v. Oracle was atypical in how it handled its fair use analysis. While ultimately it found the copied code to be transformative fair use, rather than focusing on the first factor, because the Supreme Court had sidestepped answering the first question presented by the parties, whether the allegedly infringing code was copyrightable, the majority opinion actually spent a significant portion of the analysis talking about the nature of the copyrighted work under the second factor, and noting that the code that was at issue is further from the heart of copyrighted works than other types of works. On the other hand, the court further commented on the great societal benefits evinced by engaging in the unauthorized copying, which had occurred, because it would result in less expensive development of new software programs, and that would be a great benefit to the public. So on the one hand, the comment that software is far from the core of copyright gave creators some comfort. On the other, the sweeping comments regarding the public benefits springing from unauthorized takings gave them some pause, as you might anticipate. It remains to be seen how impactful Google v. Oracle will be beyond software, but early signs are that it might remain cabined to its facts, at least for the time being. And I base that primarily on a decision that came based on the fact that the decision came down 10 days after the Second Circuit had decided Andy Warhol Foundation v. Goldsmith, and that the Second Circuit then actually heard that case en banc at the request of the Andy Warhol Foundation as a result of the Supreme Court decision. So I'll just say a few words about the Andy Warhol case before wrapping up, in case you're not familiar with it. So the Andy Warhol Foundation case, which was referred to briefly, concerned Andy Warhol's use of photographer Lynn Goldsmith's photograph of Prince to create a series of 15 works. Warhol had originally been commissioned by Vanity Fair to create an image for use in the magazine, and Vanity Fair had licensed the artist reference image from Goldsmith. Warhol often worked in series of works, and indeed here he created not one image, but a series of 15. After Prince's death, the Andy Warhol Foundation was approached by Vanity Fair to license yet another image for use in a commemorative magazine, and Goldsmith found out that her work had been used further than she had licensed it to be used. The Southern District of New York initially ruled in favor of Andy Warhol Foundation, applying precedent in the Second Circuit on fair use and finding transformativeness. The Second Circuit reversed and clarified, narrowing the precedent somewhat, but I would argue, actually in this case, muddying the waters, particularly for appropriation artists. And those who don't hew to particular types of art forms in the visual arts in particular. Andy Warhol Foundation filed and obtained rehearing en banc, which, if you follow the Second Circuit, is almost unheard of. They are the circuit which hears the fewest en banc cases. However, the Second Circuit issued an amended opinion, reiterating and clarifying its earlier opinion, but making no helpful changes from Warhol's perspective. A final procedural note, just as with Google v. Oracle, which sidestepped the copyrightability issue to focus on transformative fair use, the Southern District of New York and the Second Circuit could have decided the case on substantial similarity grounds or remanded for further proceedings on that basis, but chose not to. Instead, they proceeded directly to fair use and decided it on transformativeness grounds. And I view this, again, as a problem for artists. Although the Second Circuit's en banc opinion does contain a brief analysis of why Goldsmith would have prevailed on substantial similarity, I think presuming substantial similarity or presuming copyrightability is a matter of law rather than providing artists and other secondary users the guideposts for acceptable uses based on which elements of a work are copyrightable and which are not does a disservice because it makes it harder for laymen in the field to know what you can and can't do, and transformative use decisions sadly don't do that. And I'll end there.
Great. Well, thank you so much. So we have about a half an hour left. What I'd like to do is to allow the panelists to comment on any statements that others have made or questions for each other, and then also with that incorporate questions from the audience. So if folks have questions, there's two microphones over there. If you just want to stand up at those, and then I'll see you, and then we can hop over to audience questions. But for now, let's start off with any comments or questions between the panelists, beginning with Professor Ramsey, and then we can kind of organically grow from that.
All right, thank you. And I realize I forgot to thank you, so thank you for moderating our panel. So my question is for Karen, but I guess it could go to any of you. There's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but there's no Digital Millennium Trademark Act. And so one of the things that I'm concerned about in my field is that once someone complains to an online marketplace that they own a registered trademark, often, you know, Amazon, eBay, Etsy, you know, Etsy, Cafe Press, Zazzle will take it down without considering whether or not this is actually a valid trademark. They don't consider whether there's a likelihood of confusion, so you can't argue that they're, you know, this private company is even regulating misleading commercial speech, right? And so to me, that it's very harmful that you have this private company just automatically taking down product listings. And a number of small businesses have complained about this on the Facebook page group called Trademark Watchdogs. So my question for you is, do you think, based on the problems with the DMCA, do you think that perhaps we should have a DMTA? If not, you know, what changes might we make to the DMCA or to IP laws generally to protect the ability of people to express themselves both in commercial speech and non-commercial speech in online marketplaces?
Yeah, no. Thanks for the question. I will confess, I'm a total copyright nerd, so I'm not a trademark specialist. So I will just kind of give my own personal kind of off-the-cuff response, as opposed to, I think, a reasoned trademark response. But I will say that I think one of the concerns that, from the copyright perspective, we would have with a DMTA, as you would call it, would be some of the ongoing issues that we already see with the DMCA itself. And I think the main issue, and I don't want to sound like a kind of a Groundhog Day, which we often do on the content side, is this issue of the whack-a-mole problem that we have in the DMCA context, where you have millions and millions and millions of infringements. You send millions and millions of notices. They come down and then they go back up. And if that is going to be what happens with the DMTA, that you just have a whack-a-mole problem that is transferred from the DMCA to the DMTA, I don't know that that would actually be any better than what you have now. And I think there's a growing recognition, as I said, that the DMCA certainly has perhaps shown its age, so to speak, and that there is a need to consider kind of, again, what level responsibility. So the DMCA has been, as I noted, really construed in a way to put most of the burden on the content industry in terms of policing copyright infringement online. We wouldn't want to transfer, again, that over to the DMTA, so as opposed to a system that really places all of the burden on the content side, would there be something new in the trademark arena that you would be able to develop that actually put more responsibility on the online services, potentially, to work collaboratively with the trademark owners in a better way? People discuss the DMCA and the fact that initially it was to incentivize voluntary cooperation between content and technology, but again, the way that case law has interpreted the DMCA to give often a pass for technology, the balance has kind of de-incentivized that type of cooperation in some areas. So how do we ensure that if we look at, again, a trademark counterpart, that incentive really is at the forefront, and so that the responsibility levels are equal? So that would be my one concern with kind of trying to replicate the DMCA with the DMTA.
So one thing that might work, and again, I'm also a copyright nerd and not a trademark expert, but one thought that I would actually welcome your input on is whether you think something like the UDRP process that exists for squatting on trademarked, names, website names, might be adapted somehow to work in a DMCA-like space.
Okay, so for those of you that don't know the UDRP, so the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy is a policy that's been adopted by basically a number of, I guess it's intergovernmental organization, ICANN, and if you basically register a domain name, you agree to arbitrate any disputes if someone who owns a trademark complains that you've registered a domain name that includes their trademark. And so the World Intellectual Property Organization might hear a dispute about these claims that you violated the trademark rights. Most of the time, trademark owners win, but every now and then, panelists will find that this is a legitimate use of a trademark, right? And someone might be engaging in free speech activities, for example. I think I actually had a student write a paper as to whether we should do this for the copyright context. I mean, the benefit of this is it's very inexpensive. These days, no one files a lawsuit if someone registers a domain name, right? You just go to this inexpensive, domain name dispute resolution provider service at WIPO or one of these other organizations. But the challenges, I think, there are many challenges, though, in the copyright context, right? With trademark law, often they'll require registration or other proof that you own a valid trademark. Copyright, maybe that would be easy to say that you have a valid copyright and the registration. But, issues of infringement, fair use. I mean, the problem is these kinds of panels, these private dispute resolution providers, just like online marketplaces, right, are not really in a position to, I think, be making these judgments. It's so much easier for them just to take it down if you're an online marketplace. And so, right now, we have the Copyright Small Claims Board, which is going to be available to people who want to resolve copyright claims and if they don't want to file a lawsuit. I'm not an expert on that. I'm the trademark person on this panel, but I think that what I would support would be a way for copyright owners and trademark owners to enforce their rights, right? If they're legitimate owners of legitimate rights, in a way that's less expensive. Just as I would like small businesses and individuals to be able to engage in fair use of copyright expression, but also put common phrases on the front of T-shirts and things like that.
I think one question is, and I don't have the answer to this, I'm not a technological person at all, but maybe Karen or the panel or the audience, and that is, as you're pointing out, DMCA is over 20 years old now, and it was fashioned to give these very broad immunities to ISPs, internet service providers. So in part, they didn't have to be policing all the time, and therefore become a sort of clogged common carrier. But now technology has developed quite a bit in the last 20 years. So is it much easier now for them to police, to become aware of repeat infringers under the subsection I and things like that. Are they now able to do this? Is that notion of burdening the common carrier not so salient now?
Well, I think that those are really important conversations and questions that are actually literally taking place right now. As I said, you know, the hearings that Senator Tillis has done, as well as the draft DMCA bill. And I think overseas, this is an issue that, you know, they've been addressing as well with, you know, some legislation coming out in the EU on this issue. And it an acknowledgement, actually, I think, in some jurisdictions that, yes, they can do more, that the burden is not as high, and a resulting, actually, I would say, proliferation of more voluntary agreements, where you know, in some countries you've actually have ISPs, like in the Netherlands and Spain and Germany, where they've actually worked with content, the content industry, to see if there is a way to develop no fault injunctive relief, and you know, they have actually developed various procedures either through a self regulation in Germany or through a no fault injunctive kind of case law agreement, not to oppose in Spain, where the ISPs in the past probably would say, absolutely not. I'm not going to, you know, even think to work on, you know, no-fault injunctive relief. But in those countries, they've actually recognized they are able to do it, and they have done it, and it hasn't broken the internet, and it actually hasn't, you know, caused any of those, you know, ISPs to go out of business. So I think that there certainly is a recognition that the environment, again, has changed, and you do actually see even more willingness for ISPs to recognize that they actually do have the ability to do more. And hopefully, you know, they can do it through voluntary initiatives, because Congress always takes a long time, obviously. But, you know, we just need to make sure that the incentive remains there for them to come to the table and to discuss things voluntarily as to how can they do more in a way that doesn't cause too much burden for them, but does recognize that they do often have the technological capabilities to do more.
Yeah, I guess one point I want to talk about is to do the differences between copyright and trademark law. And I think, for example, in the copyright context, if you have you know, an identical song or an identical photograph, it's an easy decision to take it down. And usually there's not as much of a debate as to whether there's a valid copyright, although sometimes that comes up. You know, it's the fair use cases that make it difficult, where the ISP, it might be difficult for the online service provider to decide if it's fair use. So it's easy just to take it, it's easier to take it down. In the trademark context, I think the problem is that, you know, you often have trademark offices that will register, you know, again, just a subject matter that I claim is inherently valuable expression. And so you have this issue on you know, not just of, is it identical, you know, are the goods identical, but, you know, is this party entitled to rights, you know, in the first place? And so that's why I think, at least in the trademark context, the trademark office has to do a better job being a gatekeeper of the public domain and making sure that these kinds of trademarks are not registered if it's, you know, language or communicative symbols that should remain in the public domain. I mean, so people these days apply to register hand gestures. Gene Simmons of the rock band Kiss tried to register the devil's horn hand gesture, and after other musicians complained, he withdrew the application. We just talked to my class the other day, is that I guess Royal Caribbean tried to register the fist bump for their cruise ship services. That mark was refused on failure to function grounds and lack of distinctiveness grounds. But to me, the fact that companies think they can get these kinds of trademarks is problematic. And so I think we need to have some revisions to trademark law to make it clear that we shouldn't be wasting the time of people at the Patent and Trademark Office on these kinds of trademarks.
I see we have a queue forming in the audience, so let's transition to questions from the audience. If you could begin with your name and your affiliation. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. I'm Anthony Pericolo. I go to Harvard Law School, and my question has to do with the right of publicity. So it's been expanding lately, so I wanted to hear your thoughts about that, specifically how you think it implicates the First Amendment. Do you think it's a good thing, or do you, as in it recognizes one's control over his or her identity? And if you think it's a problem, how do you think it should be addressed? Thank you.
Well, I teach right of publicity law, so I guess I can start. So I'm a big supporter of the right of publicity. I think that, you know, free speech issues have to be taken into account, just like they do in trademark law. You know, people should have a right to make money off of their name or their image. And so, you know, there's a little bit of crossover into trademark law. I mentioned before the Trump Too Small application. Someone who's critical of Trump had filed to register this, and there's a provision in the Lanham Act that prevents registration of an individual's name or likeness. And so the applicant claims this he was refused registration on this ground, and they said it was viewpoint discrimination. But this law is protecting the right of publicity of Trump and others whose names and images might be used as trademarks. And again, once you get a trademark registration, you can stop other people from speaking, right, from using that image, that name, in connection with goods and services. So I guess I'm all for sort of strong right of publicity protection. But the challenge is that we have, it's state by state. You do have a false endorsement claim that you can also file in federal court, and so get it into federal court as well. And a number of people have taken advantage of both that federal law in addition to the states. But I would look at the work of Jennifer Rothman. She has a great website on the right of publicity law, and her scholarship. She's just written a book about right of publicity. So I would definitely look at her scholarship on that.
I just have to say something about right of publicity, teaching in Oklahoma as I do. Oklahoma has one of the very strongest right of publicity state laws. As Lisa was mentioning, it is state by state for right of publicity. We have a law that protects the likeness, name, voice, signature, and such for 100 years after the death of the a deceased personality, as it's called. And it reaches back, this 100-year right, reaches back to the year 1936. And it took me a while to figure out that seemed like an odd year. I mean, just why begin at 1936? And then you realize, as you think about it, that Will Rogers died in 1935. Meaning that everything, if you are in Oklahoma, everything is named after Will Rogers already. That is, turnpikes, churches. There's a Methodist church in Tulsa called the Will Rogers Methodist Church. Everything is, and so I suspect they simply wanted to avoid that problem. But it seems to me, just less anecdotally, it seems to me that, and you may have different views, these state statutes that I've looked at have quite a few exceptions in them, setting aside any judicial decisions regarding First Amendment issues, which are there too in California especially, But it seemed to me that the public's interest is fairly well protected by the statutory exceptions, the way in which, you know, a name, a likeness can be used on the cover of a biography without, for example, without permission typically. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add on that, just generally, I mean, I think that it can be a complicated issue. I think the fact that there are a number of exceptions is important. Certainly, you want to be able to, you know, you want an individual or a celebrity to have the right to be able to protect their image, but you also want to be able to reflect, you know, the freedom of contract and licensing, the ability for documentary film artists and others to be able to use folks' likeness in their films. So I do think that it's worth looking at the breadth at which these right of publicity laws are being interpreted.
Totally agree.
The only thing that I would interject here to keep in mind is how deep fakes and AI is going to affect everything.
Yes.
And when those technologies become more and more easily accessible to everyone in their homes and become, you know, people start using them to confuse political campaigns and, you know, create false endorsements for, you know, commercial purposes and so forth, which is already happening to some degree. So.
Incidentally, that Oklahoma legislative avoidance of Will Rogers has never been written about. I think I'd make a great Harvard Law Review note.
Good idea.
Well, let's go to another question from the audience.
David Askin, Houston, Texas. In a world where infringement is so pervasive and it is so expensive to litigate it, and you describe the whack-a-mole situation, is there less creative content being created because people, frankly, although it may be easier to self-publish a book on Amazon or to put your song on Apple iTunes and get 0.001 cent, you know, per download, you can't make a living in many of these creative areas any longer. And so what studies have been done with respect to the actual creation of creative content as a result of all of the problems that you've described?
Yeah, no, there have been some studies that, you know, talk about the economic impact of piracy. And, you know, on creativity, I think, you know, people often, you know, view this as an issue of just, you know, big Hollywood, as I said, or big content, and, you know, don't realize that, you know, every film has hundreds of regular middle-class workers behind it that are impacted by piracy. Artists, you know, yes, there are the Beyoncés of the world, but there are a lot of artists who really need to be able to have the economic, you know, incentive to be able to pay their mortgage every day. And when you think about how this impacts broadly, even large companies, you know, they take less risks when you have piracy. So, you know, a film company will do the, you know, Superman 25, because that would be more likely to actually make money and the piracy impact might be a little bit less than taking some of the risks on some of these more indie type films or films that might be more controversial. And, you know, you talked to Professor Spoo, which I was going to ask you a question about, you know, whether copyright serves to incentivize quality. And I actually do think that it actually does, because having the market structure that allows you to have publishing houses and film companies actually does allow for people to not only create, but actually have that quality, because you have somebody who can help edit your book and your film can be edited. So I think piracy, you know, unfortunately impacts risk-taking, and it makes you have just less variety in terms of the type of creativity out there. And while I think individuals will always create, it does impact quality, because publishing houses might not take on that next, you know, J.K. Rowling or whomever, because they don't, because it's too risky. And so therefore, you know, you self-publish it, but you don't actually have the quality that you might have if you've, for example, worked with an actual editor to get your product out or get your work out.
I mean, it's hard to study a negative. You know, how do you measure what has not been created?
Right.
But I run a clinic for individuals and small businesses, and so the people who come to us for enforcement help, whether it's, you know, DMCA takedowns or cease and desist letters, or, you know, just like help me measure how far my work has been infringed so I can try and figure out what's going on, are also telling us, well, I used to do this full time, but now I do this in the evenings. So there are anecdotal studies. There are the records of U.S. Copyright Office proceedings on 512, which is, you know, the DMCA section dealing with notice and takedown, are replete with testimony from individuals and small businesses to that effect. So,
you know, I do a lot of work in, actually, I probably work more nowadays with informal norms that protect intellectual property or try to, than I do with copyright. I've done a lot of work in 19th century American publishers who were who crafted their own mini market, untouched by federal copyright incentives for foreign authors' works, which were unprotected by U.S. copyright, really until 1891. Very interesting. But the whole scholarship on norms has developed tremendously. Areas that can be, at least to some extent, covered by copyright, for example, or trademarks, are dealt with in various communities as a normative thing. Tattoo artists, for example. Even clown makeup recently has
fan fiction
I was about to mention is a huge one. And I wonder if to some extent we can't measure the way both copyright and fair use don't touch creative communities when we look closely at these norms of fan fiction writers and such. Rebecca Tushnet has done a great deal of work, for example, on fan fiction. And I mean, I'm married to an artist, a visual artist, painter, and know quite a bit about the norms of that community. These norms seem to me to be virtually, and this is actually an interesting question I was going to raise with Sandra, because you mentioned that fair use transformativeness, as it has been developed doctrinally, is not really helping creators, and I agree in many ways with that. And yet I wonder, so many of these communities really seem to be untouched by, unaware of, perhaps even indifferent to what the law says. When I talk to many artists, they have a whole set of crafted norms, crazy things sometimes. From my view as a copyright lawyer and scholar, they'll say, oh, well, as long as you change 25% of the thing that you're using, you'll be fine.
Which we so disabuse them of when they come to the clinic.
I mean, these are.
I mean, I can tell you these norms that we hear, right? It's like, oh, as long as you only take 10 seconds.
If I mail my manuscript to my sense, then I, as a registrar of copyrights, you must really.
Which is not accurate.
Right. But I mean, so anyway, I guess just generally, I mean, there's a whole world of creative activity out there, very much on these blogs and chat rooms. That are kind of, I mean, they remind me a little bit of the aspirations that that young people in urban communities have to make it great as a professional athlete. There's this aspiration that they're going to become 50 Shades of Grey, kind of, and yet it's all, in a sense, ungoverned by.
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, 50 Shades of Grey is a fan work of the Twilight vampire series. So.
Yeah. So, you know. What do we do?
Note,
you know,
yes.
What do we do about all that?
Next question from the audience, and if you could begin with your name and affiliation.
That's two for Lisa on the.
Is this microphone? Oh, there we go. Okay, yes, my name is Paul Kaminar. I'm an attorney here in Washington. I don't practice in the area and appreciate this panel. I just always had a question about how far parody goes. I'm thinking of Weird Al Yankovic, where he takes Michael Jackson's Beat It and makes it into Eat It. And personally, I had experience where I took the lyrics from Ace's How Long Has This Been Going On to update it to COVID, where how long will this be going on? And the rest of the lyrics dealt with COVID. I had a friend who's in the music business. He sang it and dubbed it over the soundtrack. But then was told, oh, you better not release that or put it on the internet because that would be copyright infringement. So those are the kind of general question on what are the limits of parody and taking the lyrics that are not parodying the song, but taking the soundtrack and making your own lyrics on a different topic altogether.
Yeah, I mean,
are you a singer? Can you give us any more?
That's why I had a friend sing it, you know, but I'm a great writer, so.
I was going to say, I tell my students, you just have to say, it depends, right? And as lawyers, we love the fact that it's case-by-case analysis, right? No, but I think, Sandra, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say I would listen to your friend on that one. There are a number of cases where people have done this and done this even, like, in political contexts where you would think you might have some higher expectations of free speech rights. There's a case out of California, Henley v. DeVoe, where Don Henley sued, involving a parody of his song, The Boys of Summer, and All She Wants to Do Is Dance, where the lyrics were rewritten to poke fun, not just at Obama, but also at Henley for his political views. And there was significant rewriting of the lyrics, and there was parodying of the author. In the analysis, the court found that parody of the author was, you know, weighing slightly in favor on the first factor, but that, you know, there was too much of the song used and too many other elements used, and so the parodist lost. And then just recently in the Second Circuit at the end of September in the Eddie Grant v. Trump case, which some of you may have heard of, where Trump used, the Trump campaign used 55 seconds of Eddie Grant's Electric Avenue in a tweet animation making fun of Biden, he didn't change any of the lyrics or anything, but the analysis in the Second Circuit opinion, you know, goes through all of this, all of these issues, and says that, well, in the Second Circuit, you would actually have to change, you know, not just the lyrics to poke fun at the author, as in Henley, but you would have to parody the underlying work itself. So there is a difference between the circuits, I would say, in terms of how they would deal with it. But certainly, just changing the words, you know, not it's actually a satire rather than a parody.
You know, I mean, parody is really in its way quite limited as a fair use.
Yeah.
As a fair use.
But you have to get into the parody box, is the problem.
Well, I mean,
right?
Yeah, you got to get it into the box. And what you've got to do is be targeting. I mean, your interest, for example, in how long, as applying it to COVID, was not a parody, really. What you want to do is you want to extend it to a kind of satirical or yes. clever comment on. And that, at least in the Ninth Circuit's reading of the earlier Dr. Seuss case, that couldn't survive as a parody fair use. Right. Parody's quite limited, really. It's got to target the thing. Now, Weird Al Yankovic does this.
Well, and I think he has licenses.
But he gets licenses. Right. Yeah, but, you know, a guy like him is wealthy enough to have belt and suspenders, right? So yeah. Well, that's the way he does it.
Yeah, and I want to live in a world where we have parodies. I'm a Hamilton fan, and there was one that came out, The Zoom Where It Happens, which I highly recommend. But they weren't making fun of Hamilton, right? They were making fun of what was going on, you know, at the time of the early days of the coronavirus. And so I think that, you know, parody is important doctrine in copyright and trademark law, but I think we also need to all consider the benefits of satire, right? Of commentary that's not necessarily about the copyright owner or the trademark owner, but also commentary about society, the world we live in. And, you know, in Campbell, the Supreme Court said that satire needs a greater justification for borrowing because they're worried about, you know, using it to grab attention or free riding. So I think it's very difficult. I mean, often it might just come down to whether the judge or jury, you know, likes your parody or your, you know, your expression, which that shouldn't be the, you know, unfortunately, but that's the reality. So, you know.
So I want to end on time. I think we have 1 minute left, according to my phone here. I just wanted to see if there were any closing comments from the panelists before we have a round of applause for everyone.
No, thank you for a great discussion.
Thank you.
Closing comments.